following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
Every now and then, I encounter somebody who believes they are just too far gone. People say to me, Pastor, you don't know what I've done. I am not a good person. There's no way God could ever want anything from somebody like me. And people use that as kind of an excuse to keep church at arm's length because they don't feel worthy to even approach God. And what's really scary is that I often encounter people like this in the church. People are here and they acknowledge with their heads that God loves and Jesus saves, but in their hearts, they can't get over this suspicion that for some reason they are in the kingdom of God by the skin of their teeth. And they're always looking over their shoulder and they're afraid their past is going to come back and haunt them and that they are simply second-class citizens among God's people. Now, if I just described you, the story we're going to look at today from Mark 5 verses 1 through 20 is just for you. Because in Mark 5 verses 1 through 20, we're shown that no one living is beyond the reach of Jesus. If you'll join with me as I read the first few verses of this passage. They came to the other side of the sea in the country of the Gerasenes. And when he got out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. And he had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. Constantly, night and day, he was screaming among the tombs and in the mountains, and gashing himself with stones. Seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him. Now, Mark, in this passage, introduces us to a man who is about as distant from God as a person can be. When we last saw Jesus and his disciples at the end of chapter 4, they were in a boat headed to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Jesus said, come, let's go to the other side. So they got in the boat. And as chapter 5 opens, they've arrived in what Mark calls the country of the Gerasenes. Now, this is an area on the northeastern side of the Sea of Galilee, near what we know today as the Golan Heights. Perhaps you've heard that place mentioned in the news before. It's a very strategic piece of land in that part of the world. Now, in Jesus' day, this area was settled predominantly by Gentiles or non-Jews. That means that the local culture was influenced more by Greek paganism than it was Jewish monotheism. In other words, this was, in a lot of ways, a godless place. Why Jesus would want to go there, we don't know. We're not told. But he went. And right away, this location involves us in a little bit of controversy. Now, I don't want to chase this particular rabbit too far, but I do want you to be aware, in case you ever run into this. Mark identifies the setting of this story as the country of the Gerasenes, connecting this location to a large town in that region called Gerasa. Now, Matthew tells this same story in chapter 8 of his gospel, only he identifies the setting as a village known as Gadara. Gerasa, Gadara. And right there, some critics point to that and say, there you go, right there, see? See, you can't trust the Bible. It's got mistakes in it. Give me a break. Okay, there is actually no discrepancy here. Let me explain it to you. As any police officer, first of all, will tell you, two different people can look at the same event from two different perspectives and still tell a true story, even though they disagree in some of the fine details. Secondly, it's likely that neither of those locations was the actual setting where the event took place. Okay? Note that Mark says this incident took place in the country of the Gerasenes, or the region of the Gerasenes, because that's one of the largest cities in that region. It's kind of like today, if I said to you, hey, there's something that happened in Botetourt. And you would say, what? That sounds like something you get at Sonic. But if I said, this something happened in Roanoke, Virginia, all of a sudden, oh, wait a minute, I've heard of that. Well, Botetourt's a county right next to Roanoke. But unless you were from Virginia, you probably didn't know that. So, Gerasa dominates this area, so it's a natural landmark for Mark to tell people how to place this. The big problem with this being the scene is, even though Gerasa is a large town, it is too far inland. It's nowhere close to the shore of the Sea of Galilee. Gadara, on the other hand, is much closer to the shore, but it's got problems too. First of all, it's down on the southern end of this area, which is known as the Decapolis in those days, and there's no steep slope near Gadara that runs into the sea like it's described in this story, so it doesn't really fit the geography, even though it's closer to the sea. However, there is a location in between these two towns that might actually have been the backdrop of this story. There's a little tiny village called Gargesa. At least that's what it was called in those days. Today it's known by its Arab name, El Kursi. But it's a little village, and it's in between Gadara and Gargesa, and the other town here, and it's right on the shore. Okay? In fact, today it's right across the highway from the beach. And it's right next to a steep slope that runs down into the water, as is mentioned here in this passage. And there are ridges nearby where there are caves that people in the first century used as tombs, which are mentioned in the verses we just read. So is it the location? I don't know. I got to visit it about 20 years ago. Let me tell you, it was a foggy day when we were there. It was really spooky, especially considering this story. It's got all the features. It's in the right place. It could fit. But in the end, the exact location is not as important as what took place there. Because as Jesus and his disciples got out of that boat, they were met by a man that Mark says had an unclean spirit. Now, the Bible, to my knowledge, never actually uses this phrase, but this man was suffering from what we today call demon possession. In other words, Mark is describing a man whose body and personality have been taken over by a malevolent spiritual entity from the outside. Now, some people say, well, that just sounds like he's crazy or he's insane. I've seen homeless people acting like this on the street. Well, let me remind you, when Mark has described this phenomena earlier in his gospel, he was very, very careful to use a different vocabulary to distinguish between normal illnesses and this condition, okay? The people in Mark's day, they may not have known a lot about mental illness, but they apparently understand the difference between a disorder with a natural cause and something like it's being described here. I mean, there's crazy and then there's crazy. This was beyond the scale, okay? And what is being described here is not an ordinary case of mental illness. It naturally begs the question for us modern people, do demons exist? Hey, the Bible assumes they do. Now, in our modern materialistic scientific worldview, we in the West have blinded ourselves to anything that we can't see, touch, taste, hear, smell, put in a test tube, dissect, all that. So we've cut ourselves off just by our presumptions from many spiritual realities that exist around us. However, you go to places in the world where that's not the predominant worldview, like on the mission field and some foreign countries where people are a little more open to spiritual influences and the supernatural, and what we see are reports of incidents that look a whole lot like what the Bible describes right here. To quote Shakespeare, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Even for those of us who tend to look at the world through scientific eyes with our little blinders on, guess what? We occasionally do run into evil that is so terrible our modern scientific understanding cannot explain it. And I have a prediction for you. You know, paganism is making a resurgence in the world, and I think as paganism gets more of a foothold in our modern society, I think we may start seeing more and more overt spiritual phenomena like this. Now, in the Bible, demons are described as fallen angels who rebelled against God, and they became corrupted and warped by their pride and their hatred. Now, they know they can't hope to attack God directly. So what they do is they seek to attack God indirectly by attacking those whom God loves and what he creates. It's kind of like you. Somebody can't get to you, they go after your kids, right? These things don't fight fair. Most of the time, these entities are described not as taking over somebody, but as simply manipulating them, whispering in their ear, planting suggestions, manipulating individuals, even manipulating whole nations. There are passages in the Bible that describe countries and the leadership of those countries being influenced by these malevolent entities. And that brings up a good point here. No, you don't have to be possessed by a demon in order to be influenced by one. I've seen churches where it's possible that Satan and his demons have been having a field day. Now, I have a kind of a pet peeve. I don't like pastors that spiritualize every conflict in a church, okay? You know, you get some guys, anybody disagrees with them, well, that person's been run by Satan. I am not, that is not me, okay? I think sometimes we just have disagreements. And that's normal. Iron sharpens iron. When iron rubs against iron, what do you get? You get sparks, okay? But I do believe there are occasions where Satan gets his claws into a church, and let me tell you, it's very, very hard to pry those out. And it's very, very painful. And what he does, especially if you're trying to start something good, you're trying to get a church on task, on mission, reaching its community, having an impact, lifting up Jesus, and man, it's just like all of a sudden stuff starts happening out of left field. And you're like, what in the world is going on? When that happens, let me tell you, it's not the time to point fingers, okay? What you need to do is get on your knees and pray. Say, God, break those chains. Break that grip. Pry out those claws and help us to all come together around Jesus. In the Bible, demons are described as seeking to manipulate both individuals and even whole nations toward destructive ends. Just a few days ago, the world commemorated the Holocaust. Ask yourself this question: how can the same nation that gave us Martin Luther, Mozart, and von Goethe have so casually oversaw the extermination of 6 million people in just a few years? Tell me that's not demonic. I could give some other examples too, like a nation I know about that's tolerated the murder of 40 million unborn children, but that's another story. Preach it. Man, some things are just so evil. You say, how could a human heart have come up with that on its own? As Jesus stated it in John's gospel, the thief comes only to steal, to kill, and to destroy. And these entities had apparently been stealing, killing, and destroying this man's life for years. Consider the barriers that are keeping this man from God. First of all, we're told he was disassociated. In other words, I mean, to begin with, he was a Gentile. He wasn't part of God's chosen people. He wasn't what we would call churched. He had not grown up being taught God's word and God's revelation and hearing about God and what God was trying to do in people's lives. He was as far from God by birth as anyone could be. He grew up worshiping idols and natural forces and all these things. He was a pagan. He wasn't one of God's people. He was also defiled. He lived in an unclean place. He lived among the dead, in the cemetery. That's not normal. He was controlled by an unclean or unholy spirit. So he was defiled through this. He was demon infested, not just by one demon, we're told. You jump down to verse 9, and Jesus is dialoguing with these entities, and he says, what is your name? And he said to him, my name is Legion, for we are many. Now, a legion was a Roman military unit of between 4,000 and 6,000 men. Now, that doesn't mean that there were literally 6,000 demons in this guy. But you read later in verse 13 that there's enough to drive 2,000 pigs into the water. So there's a bunch of demons, not just one. Can you imagine all those voices inside you compelling you to do unholy things? No wonder this guy acted crazy. He was also driven out. The reason he lived in the tombs was because the villagers had driven him out of the town. They saw him as a threat. They sought to contain him, to bind him with chains. He was also dangerous because this army of demons inside him gave him supernatural strength to burst these bonds. He couldn't even be contained in chains. We're told that no one was strong enough to subdue him. And he was distressed. Look at how he's described here, running around constantly, night and day, screaming among the tombs in such torment and distress and screaming. Can you imagine the village at night? They're sitting there, trying to eat their supper, and they hear this guy screaming out in the hills, Mom, Dad, what's that? Oh, stay away from there. That's a bad place. That guy hurt you. He's just not right. He's also described as cutting himself, gashing himself with stones. He's cutting. He is involved in self-destructive behavior because of this oppression and affliction that he is suffering through. Many reports today of suspected demon possession are characterized by much the same behavior. People being driven to hurt themselves, to destroy themselves for some reason. This compulsion to damage their bodies or to just self-destruct. Perhaps today you find yourself in a bad place. Perhaps it's cloudy, it's dark. You don't know how you got there. But I just about guarantee you, you're not in a demon-infested, running around in rags and chains, screaming your head off in the middle of the night, living in a graveyard kind of place, are you? Man, if Jesus can reach this guy, imagine what he can do for you. Even in his distress, this man was drawn to Jesus. Mark tells us, you know, when he saw Jesus from a distance. Now think of this. This man is infested with these unholy spirits. And usually, when you see somebody who reminds you that you're guilty, what's our tendency to do? Run away, right? No, this guy runs to Jesus. And when he gets there, he throws himself down on the ground in front of Jesus like a beggar. The word is literally prostrate, face down in the dirt before Jesus. Because here's the thing that these entities recognized. Jesus is superior to all the powers of darkness. In verse 7, shouting with a loud voice, this is the man shouting. He said, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you, do not torment me." For he had been saying to him, "Come out of the man, unclean spirit." And when he was asking him, "What is your name?" And he said to him, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he began to implore him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now there was a large herd of swine feeding nearby on the mountains. The demons implored him, saying, "Send us into the swine that we may enter them." Jesus gave them permission. And coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them. And they were drowned in the sea. These demons prostrated themselves in recognition of Jesus' divine authority. The wording suggests the man got down on his knees, his face in the dirt before Jesus. And in that culture, that was a posture of submission, even worship, if you would. He's acknowledging Jesus' superior authority. The demons recognized Jesus' identity even when those who were created in God's image could not. You know, the entity speaking through this man addressed Jesus by name. They knew who he was. Jesus. And then they address him by title, Son of the Most High God. Now that's even more exalted than the title that Mark gives him in chapter 1, verse 1, where he identifies him as the Son of God. He's Son of the Most High God. Now remember, if you will, if you were here with us last week, how the story last week ended? Jesus is in the boat, storm comes up, the disciples are freaking out. "Lord, do you care that we're perishing?" Jesus stands up and does something only God has the power to do. He commands the storm to be calm, and it was. And what's the question the disciples are left wondering? Who is this guy? Guess who answers that question? A bunch of demons. And this is not the first time in Mark's gospel we see the demons giving testimony to Jesus' identity, even as the human audience is still wrestling with that question. Who is this guy? Jesus, Son of the Most High God. And the demons recognized the threat that Jesus presented for their existence. Through this man, they say, "What business do we have with each other?" They also implore or beg Jesus, "Do not torment us." Jesus' very presence was tormenting them. The reason they prostrated themselves in front of Jesus is because they knew he represented their eventual demise. He represented God breaking back into this world to reassert his rightful rule and authority. He represented the day when God would bring human history to a close and allow this world to burn and bring about the new heaven and the new earth that we read about in other places, when perfect justice will be done and there will be no more evil or injustice or suffering. They realized he represented the day when they would be toast. These unholy creatures knew that when God began to reassert his authority on earth, they were doomed. Now, contrary to popular culture, this is not some kind of equal contest. You look at a lot of movies Hollywood puts out and stuff, and it's almost like good and evil are balanced out, you know? And it's a contest. I wonder who's going to win. Hey, according to the Bible, there is no contest. The ending is not in doubt, only the timing. Satan and his minions have no more hope of resisting God and His Son than the darkness has hope of resisting the light. When you walk into a dark room and you turn on the light, what happens to the darkness? It's gone. And according to Matthew's gospel, that's what's going to happen to these entities. We're told in Matthew's gospel, God has prepared an eternal fire. Think of a big, smoldering, burning garbage dump for these entities. For the devil and his angels, Jesus said in Matthew 25. In the book of Revelation, we're told about a lake of fire reserved for Satan and his minions. Listen to me. Hell was never intended for human souls. It was created for the devil and his angels. However, those who've rejected God's light will find themselves dragged there in the devil's wake. In Jesus, God has offered us a rescuer who is able to bring us safely home if we'll let Him. As the old preacher once said, hey, if you've accepted the hand of the rescuer, then the next time Satan and his minions try to remind you of your past, you just remind him of his future. Because Jesus is greater, and He has won. And if you've hooked yourself to Jesus or allowed Him to put His grasp on you, if you've responded to His invitation, His grace, His mercy, if you belong to Him, then your future is assured too. Look at what these demons do next. I mean, realizing the threat Jesus represents for their very existence, they beg Him for mercy. Now, it's important to know these demons are not trying to negotiate here, okay? They're not saying, let's make a deal. Instead, their actions are more like a child trying to avoid the inevitable discipline of a parent. I got pretty good kids. They've not given us a whole lot of trouble. They don't want me talking about them either, so I got to be careful about this. I didn't ask permission, so I'm going to hear about this later. But like most kids, every now and then, they got to be reminded who's in charge. I'm a real gentle type father. I don't try to be domineering or anything. Sometimes my kids, try to take advantage of that fact. And sometimes they don't realize that. They think they're having fun, and they don't realize Dad's serious. So I have to remind them that, I am serious. And this old dog does bite sometimes. And this has happened on a few occasions. They'll be messing around, tell them to do something. They're messing around. They're not going to do it. They're playing around. They think it's funny. And then all of a sudden, I got to do something to get their attention. And it's amazing how the sound of a belt leaving the belt loops will focus a person's attention intently. Not that I ever beat my kids, okay? Don't get me wrong. But, the belt comes out, and all of a sudden, I have their undivided attention. But that sets up another interesting dilemma. Because then, and this hadn't happened in a while because they're mostly grown now. But all of a sudden, they start trying to negotiate. And it's not that they're trying to get out of punishment. What they're afraid of, it's almost like they're afraid if they turn around to go do what I've told them to do, that I'm going to ignite their afterburners on the way out, if you get what I mean. It's like they don't trust me. And that's exactly what these demons are doing. Hey, okay, Jesus, we'll leave, but. And so they ask to go into the swine. And they obeyed Jesus' command to depart the afflicted man here. And Jesus gives a word. He says it's okay. They leave the man. They flood into this herd of pigs nearby. And the herd of pigs immediately goes wild and stampede into the lake, leading to the destruction of not only the pigs, but the demons. That's implied. Sometimes modern people look at this. They look at this and go, how dare he? Those poor pigs. Okay, first of all, you got to understand, first century Jews didn't look at pigs the same way you and I may do it. Okay. First of all, those were unclean animals. Second of all, they were livestock, okay? And my mom grew up on a farm. She'll tell you never give names to the livestock. Because you don't want to be eating Bessie there sooner or later. So they didn't look at this the same way. Second of all, notice Jesus did not command them to go into the pigs. He only permitted it. Going into the pigs was their idea. And after the demons left this man, here's the thing. His sanity returned. The revelation of Jesus confronts us with a choice concerning our response to Him. Pick it up in verse 14. Listen to this change here and the contrast here between this man and his neighbors. The herdsman, the pig's herdsman, ran away and reported it to the city and in the country. And the people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed sitting down, clothed, and in his right mind. The very man who'd had the legion. And they became frightened. Wait a minute. They were frightened before. Why are they frightened now? Demons are gone. This guy's no threat anymore. Well, pay attention. Those who had seen it described to them how it happened that the demon-possessed man and all about the swine, and they began to implore him, in other words, Jesus, to leave their region. So the townspeople look at Jesus, and here's the thing. Those who choose comfort or convenience over Christ reveal that their hearts are far away from God. Because these town people look at Jesus, and they saw a threat to their way of life. I guarantee you this is what's going through their minds. See, they could manage that possessed man. You know, they chased him out. He's living in the graveyard. As long as he stays out there, he's no threat to anybody. We can go about our business. He's called a strong man, actually. You remember this in verse 4. It says, no one was strong enough to subdue him. That may have pricked something else to your mind earlier where Jesus talks about, you know, when people accused him of casting out demons by the power of demons, says, you know, before you can cast out the strong man, you have to bind the strong man. So what Jesus represents is somebody stronger than this guy because he cast the demons out. So, you know, they can manage the guy when he was possessed. They're not so sure they can manage Jesus. We let this guy stick around, he may upset our apple cart. There may be some changes go along. We may have to give up our way of life. There's no telling what a guy like that do. They're more scared of Jesus than they are the demon-possessed man. You know, and I know people in churches that are like that. How tragic people would choose to cling to their comfort or their convenience over God because they're afraid God may try to change them. I mean, this mentality is why some churches die. They make Christ feel unwelcome in his own church because they don't want to change. They're afraid of what he's going to do. They want to have what they can control. They're afraid if we start letting Jesus in this place, all kinds of crazy things might start happening. And so they hold on to their comfort, they hold on to their convenience, they hold on to the things they control, and they slowly, slowly die. How tragic that people would choose to cling to their comfort and their convenience over God. But those who've been truly transformed by Jesus, it's a different story. They'll feel compelled to tell others about him. In verse 18, as Jesus, was getting in the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was imploring him that he might accompany him. And he did not let them, but he said to him, go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him. And everyone was amazed. So after Jesus cast out the unholy spirits, this man is returned to wholeness and health. He's sitting there in his right mind. He's clothed. He's not cut up anymore. He can carry on a conversation. He's not screaming his head off and mumbling bizarre things that make no sense. He is sane and in his right mind. And he begs Jesus to take him on as a disciple. This word here where he says, you know, he wanted to accompany him. First of all, earlier this man's begging for Jesus to go away. Now the demons are gone. He's begging for Jesus to let him stay. But this word here, let me accompany you, it is the exact same word that Mark uses to describe Jesus' motivation for picking those original 12 disciples in chapter 3, verse 14. We're told Jesus picked these men so that they might be with him or they might accompany him. Same Greek word. But instead of letting this man go with him and get in the boat with him, Jesus instead sends him back to his family and he tells him, you go tell other people what I've done for you, what the Lord's done for you. He sent the man back to be a witness. Note that the message this man bore was simple. Okay? Look at the change the Lord made in me. He didn't have a Bible degree. He wasn't an expert in theology. All he knew was that he had met Jesus, and Jesus had changed his life. It's that simple. All you need to have is a willingness to share with the people around you what God's done for you. Who can you share your story with this week? I love it. We got all these names over here on this board. I hope you're still praying for these people. I hope you're still looking for opportunities to tell them your story. And every week I think there's maybe one or two more names over there. I've seen that thing kind of grow a little bit. Maybe you got some names you need to add to that. But who in your life can you tell your story to this week? Tell them what Jesus has done for you. By many measures, John Newton was a despicable human being. Newton was a sailor in the age of the great wooden sailing ships, okay? He was a tough old salt, let me tell you. By all accounts, he was a hard-drinking, hard-swearing, profane, violent man. Once a captain of his ship humiliated him, and Newton spent a long time trying to scheme on how he could kill that guy to get back at him. Worst of all, Newton worked in the darkest of all nautical trades, transporting slaves from Africa to Europe. Innocent people, stolen from their families, chained up like animals, crammed into those hot, humid, dirty holds of those ships like cordwood, with little food, little water, little hygiene, taken to a far-off land where they didn't speak the language, where they didn't know anyone, where they are treated like property and sold to masters who would dominate them and beat them into submission. And Newton helped facilitate that trade. Imagine how hard, how cold, how dark a person's heart must be able to help that kind of thing happen. In 1848, Newton's ship was caught in a storm and almost sank. He did like a lot of people when they've had a brush with death. He started dusting off a Bible and reading it. An interesting thing began to happen. The more he read the Bible, the more fascinated he became with this character known as Jesus. And the more his heart began to change. Until one day, years later, he professed his faith in Jesus, his Savior and Lord, and repudiated his past profession. He actually became one of the leading advocates for abolition in England. This is the man who eventually wrote the words that so many of us know so well. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound, that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. If Jesus can save a man like that, imagine what he can do with you. If you'll open your life up to him and invite him to come in and take control. To turn from your old uncleanness, to turn from your own wretchedness, and set out to follow him in faith today.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.